This is Audible.
It was the great north wind that made the Vikings. Old Norwegian saying.
Simon and Schuster Audio presents Half Broke Horses, a true life novel by Jeanette Walls. Read by the author.
Chapter 1, Salt Draw. Those old cows knew trouble was coming before we did. It was late on an August afternoon, the air hot and heavy like it usually was in the rainy season. Earlier, we'd seen some thunderheads near the Burnt Spring Hills, but they'd passed way up north. I'd mostly finished my chores for the day, and was heading down to the pasture with my brother Buster and my sister Helen to bring the cows in for their milking. But when we got there, those girls were acting all bothered. Instead of milling around at the gate like they usually did at milking time, they were standing stiff-legged and straight-tailed, twitching their heads around, listening. Buster and Helen looked up at me, and without a word, I knelt down and pressed my ear to the hard-packed dirt. There was a rumbling, so faint and low you felt it more than you heard it. Then I knew what the cows knew. A flash flood was coming. As I stood up, the cows bolted, heading for the southern fence line, and when they reached the barbed wire, they jumped over it, higher and cleaner than I'd ever seen cows jump, and then they thundered off toward higher ground. I figured we'd best bolt too, so I grabbed Helen and Buster by the hand. By then, I could feel the ground rumbling through my shoes. I saw the first water sluicing through the lower part of the pasture, and I knew we didn't have time to make it to higher ground ourselves. In the middle of the field was an old cottonwood tree, broad-branched and gnarled, and we ran for that. Helen stumbled, so Buster grabbed her other hand, and we lifted her off the ground and carried her between us as we ran. When we reached the cottonwood, I pushed Buster up to the lowest branch, and he pulled Helen into the tree behind him. I shimmied up and wrapped my arms around Helen, just as a wall of water, about 6 feet high and pushing rocks and tree limbs in front of it, slammed into the cottonwood, dousing all three of us. The tree shuddered and bent over so far you could hear wood cracking, and some of the lower branches were torn off. I feared it might be uprooted, but the cottonwood held fast, and so did we. Our arms locked as a great rush of caramel-colored water, filled with bits of wood and the occasional matted gopher and tangle of snakes, surged beneath us, spreading out across the lowland and seeking its level. We just sat there in that cottonwood tree, watching for about an hour. The sun started to set over the Burnt Spring Hills, turning the high clouds crimson and sending long purple shadows eastward. The water was still flowing beneath us, and Helen said her arms were getting tired. She was only 7 and was afraid she couldn't hold on much longer. Buster, who was 9, was perched up in the big fork of the tree. I was 10, the oldest, and I took charge, telling Buster to trade places with Helen so she could sit upright without having to cling too hard. A little while later, it got dark, but a bright moon came out, and we could see just fine. From time to time, we all switched places so no one's arms would wear out. The bark was chafing my thighs, and Helen's too, and when we needed to pee, we had to just wet ourselves. About halfway through the night, Helen's voice started getting weak. "I can't hold on any longer," she said. "Yes, you can," I told her. You can because you have to. We were going to make it, I told them. I knew we would make it because I could see it in my mind. I could see us walking up the hill to the house tomorrow morning, and I could see Mom and Dad running out. It would happen, but it was up to us to make it happen. To keep Helen and Buster from drifting off to sleep and falling out of the cottonwood, I grilled them on their multiplication tables. When we'd run through those, I went on to the presidents and state capitals, then word definitions, word rhymes, and whatever else I could come up with, snapping at them if their voices faltered. And that was how I kept Helen and Buster awake through the night. By first light, you could see that the water still covered the ground. In most places, a flash flood drained away after a couple of hours. But the pasture was in bottomland near the river, and sometimes the water remained for days. But it had stopped moving and had begun seeping down through the sinkholes and mudflats. We made it, I said. I figured it would be safe to wade through the water, so we scrambled out of the cottonwood tree. We were so stiff from holding on all night that our joints could scarcely move, and the mud kept sucking at our shoes. But we got to dry land as the sun was coming up and climbed the hill to the house, just the way I'd seen it. Dad was on the porch, pacing back and forth in that uneven stride he had on account of his gimp leg. When he saw us, he let out a yelp of delight and started hobbling down the steps towards us. Mom came running out of the house. She sank to her knees, clasped her hands in front of her, and started praying up to the heavens, thanking the Lord for delivering her children from the flood. It was she who had saved us, she declared, by staying up all night praying. You get down on your knees and thank your guardian angel, she said, and you thank me too. Helen and Buster got down and started praying with Mom, but I just stood there looking at them. The way I saw it, I was the one who'd saved us all, not Mom and not some guardian angel. No one was up in that cottonwood tree except the three of us. Dad came alongside me and put his arm around my shoulders. There weren't no guardian angel, Dad, I said. I started explaining how I'd gotten us to the cottonwood tree in time, figuring out how to switch places when our arms got tired, and keeping Buster and Helen awake through the long night by quizzing them. Dad squeezed my shoulder. Well, darling, he said, maybe the angel was you. We had a homestead on Salt Draw, which flowed into the Pecos River in the rolling, gritty grassland of West Texas. The sky was high and pale, the land low and washed out, gray and every color of sand. Sometimes the wind blew for days on end, but sometimes it was so still you could hear the dog barking on the Dingler Ranch 2 miles upriver, and when a wagon came down the road, the dust it trailed hung in the air for a long time before drifting back to the ground. When you looked out across the land, most everything you could see, the horizon, the river, the fence lines, the gullies, the scrub cedar, was spread out and flat, and the people, cattle, horses, lizards, and water all moved slowly, conserving themselves. It was hard country. The ground was like rock, save for when a flood turned everything to mud. The animals were bony and tough, and even the plants were prickly and sparse, though from time to time the thunderstorms brought out startling bursts of wildflowers. Dad said High Lonesome, as the area was known, wasn't a place for the soft of head or the weak of heart. And he said that was why he and I made out just fine there, because we were both tough nuts. Our homestead was only 160 acres, which was not a whole lot of land in that part of Texas, where it was so dry you needed at least 5 acres to raise a single head of cattle. But our spread bordered on the draw, so it was 10 times more valuable than land without water. And we were able to keep the carriage horses Dad trained, the milking cows, dozens of chickens, some hogs, and the peacocks. The peacocks were one of Dad's money-making schemes that didn't quite pan out. Dad had paid a lot of money to import breeding peacocks from a farm back east. He was convinced that peacocks were a surefire sign of elegance and style, and that folks who bought carriage horses from him would also be willing to shell out $50 for one of those classy birds. He planned to sell only the male birds, so we'd be the sole peacock breeders this side of the Pecos. Unfortunately, Dad overestimated the demand for ornamental birds in West Texas, even among the carriage set. And within a few years, our ranch was overrun with peacocks. They strutted around screeching and squawking, pecking our knees, scaring the horses, killing chicks, and attacking the hogs. Though I have to admit, it was a glorious sight when, from time to time, those peacocks paused in their campaign of terror to spread their plumes and preen. The peacocks were just the sideline. Dad's primary occupation was the carriage horses, breeding them and training them. He loved horses despite the accident. When Dad was a boy of three, he was running through the stable and a horse kicked him in the head, practically staving in his skull. Dad was in a coma for days, and no one thought he'd pull through. He eventually did, but the right side of his body had gone a little gimp. His right leg sort of dragged behind him, and his arm was cocked like a chicken wing. Also, when he was young, he'd spent long hours working in the noisy grist mill on the family's ranch, which made him hard of hearing. As such, he talked a little funny, and until you spent time around him, you had trouble understanding what he said. Dad never blamed the horse for kicking him. All the horse knew, he liked to say, was that some creature about the size of a mountain lion was darting by his flanks. Horses were never wrong. They always did what they did for a reason, and it was up to you to figure it out. And even though it was a horse that almost stove in Dad's skull, he loved horses because, unlike people, they always understood him and never pitied him. So even though Dad was unable to sit in a saddle on account of the accident, he became an expert at training carriage horses. If he couldn't ride them, he could drive them. I was born in a dugout on the banks of the Salt Draw in 1901, the year after Dad got out of prison where he'd been serving time on that trumped-up murder charge. Dad had grown up on a ranch in the Hondo Valley in New Mexico. His pa, who'd homesteaded the land, was one of the first Anglos in the valley, arriving there in 1868. But by the time Dad was a young man, more settlers had moved into the area than the river could support, and there were constant arguments over property lines, and especially water rights. People claiming their upstream neighbors were using more than their fair share of water, while downstream neighbors made the same claim against them. These disputes often led to brawls, lawsuits, and shootings. Dad's pa, Robert Casey, was murdered in one such dispute when Dad was 14. Dad stayed on to run the ranch with his ma, but those disputes kept erupting, and 20 years later, when a settler was killed after yet another argument, Dad was convicted of murdering him. Dad insisted he'd been framed, writing long letters to legislators and newspaper editors, protesting his innocence, and after serving 3 years in prison, he was set free. Shortly after he was released, he met and married my mom. The prosecutor was looking into retrying the case, and Dad thought that would be less likely if he made himself scarce. So he and my mom left the Hondo Valley for High Lonesome, where they claimed our land along the Salt Draw. Lots of the folks homesteading in High Lonesome lived in dugouts because timber was so scarce in that part of Texas. Dad had made our home by shoveling out what was more or less a big hole on the side of the riverbank, using cedar branches as rafters and covering them over with sod. The dugout had one room, a packed earth floor, a wooden door, a waxed paper window, and a cast iron stove with a flue that jutted up through the sod roof. The best thing about living in the dugout was that it was cool in the summer and not too cold in the winter. The worst thing about it was that, from time to time, scorpions, lizards, snakes, gophers, centipedes, and moles wormed their way out of our walls and ceilings. Once, in the middle of an Easter dinner, a rattler dropped onto the table. Dad, who was carving the ham, brought the knife right down behind that snake's head. Also, whenever it rained, the ceilings and walls in the dugout turned to mud. Sometimes clumps of that mud dropped from the ceiling, and you had to pat it back in place. And every now and then, the goats grazing on the roof would stick a hoof clear through and would have to pull them out. Another problem with living in the dugout was the mosquitoes. They were so thick that sometimes you felt like you were swimming through them. Mom was particularly susceptible to them. Her bite marks sometimes stayed swollen for days, but I was the one who came down with yellow jack fever. I was 7 at the time, and after the first day, I was writhing on the bed, shivering and vomiting. Mom was afraid that everyone else might catch the disease, so even though Dad insisted that you got it from mosquitoes, he rigged up a quilt to quarantine me off. Dad was the only one who was allowed behind it, and he sat with me for days, splashing me with spirit lotions, trying to bring the fever down. While I was delirious, I visited bright white places in another world and saw green and purple beasts that grew and shrank with every beat of my heart. When the fever finally broke, I weighed some 10 pounds less than I had before, and my skin was all yellow. Dad joked that my forehead had been so hot he almost burned his hand when he touched it. Mom poked her head behind the quilt to see me. "A fever that high can boil your brain and cause permanent damage," Mom said. "So don't ever tell anyone you had it. You do, you might have trouble catching a husband." Mom worried about things like her daughters catching the right husband. She was concerned with what she called proprieties. Mom had furnished our dugout with some real finery, including an oriental rug, a chaise lounge with a lace doily, velvet curtains that we hung on the walls to make it look like we had more windows, a silver serving set, and a carved walnut headboard that her parents had brought with them from back east when they moved to California. Mom treasured that headboard and said it was the only thing that allowed her to sleep at night because it reminded her of the civilized world. Mom's father was a miner who had struck gold north of San Francisco and became fairly prosperous. Although her family lived in mining boom towns, Mom, whose maiden name was Daisy May Peacock, was raised in an atmosphere of gentility. She had soft white skin that was easily sunburned and bruised. When she was a child, her mother made her wear a linen mask if she had to spend any time in the sun, tying it to the yellow curls on the side of her face. In West Texas, Mom always wore a hat and gloves and a veil over her face when she went outdoors, which she did as seldom as possible. Mom kept up the dugout, but she refused to do chores like toting water or carrying firewood. "Your mother's a lady," Dad would say by way of explaining her disdain for manual labor. Dad did most of the outdoor work with the help of our hand, Apache. Apache wasn't really an Indian, but he'd been captured by the Apaches when he was 6, and they kept him until he was a young man, when the U.S. Cavalry, with Dad's paw serving as a scout, raided the camp, and Apache ran out yelling, "Soy Blanco, Soy Blanco!" Apache had gone home with Dad's paw and lived with the family ever since. By now, Apache was an old man with a white beard, so long that he tucked it into his pants. Apache was a loner, and sometimes he spent hours staring at the horizon or the barn wall. And he'd also disappear into the range now and then, for days at a time, but he always came back. Folks considered Apache a little peculiar, but that's what they also thought of Dad, and the two of them got along just fine. To cook and wash, Mom had the help of our servant girl, Lupe, who had gotten pregnant and was forced to leave her village outside Juarez after the baby was born, because she had brought shame on the family and no one would marry her. She was small and a little barrel-shaped and even more devoutly Catholic than Mom. Buster called her Lupe, but I like Lupe. Although her parents had taken her baby away from her and she slept on a Navajo blanket on the dugout floor, Lupe never felt sorry for herself. And that was something I decided I admired most in people. Even with Lupe helping her out, Mom didn't care for life on Salt Draw. She hadn't bargained for it. Mom thought she'd married well when she took Adam Casey as her husband, despite his limp and speech impediment. Dad's pa had come over from Ireland during a potato blight, joined the 2nd Dragoons, one of the first cavalry units of the U.S. Army, where he served under Colonel Robert E. Lee, and was stationed on the Texas frontier, fighting Comanches, Apaches, and Kiowa. After leaving the Army, he took up ranching, first in Texas, then in the Hondo Valley, and by the time he was killed, he had one of the biggest herds in the area. Robert Casey was shot down as he walked along the main street of Lincoln, New Mexico. One version of the story held that he and the man who killed him had disagreed over an $8 debt. The murderer's hanging was talked about for years in the valley, because once he'd been hanged, declared dead, cut down, and put in his pine box, people heard him moving around, so they took him out and strung him up again. After Robert Casey's death, his children started arguing over how to split up the herd, which fostered bad blood that lasted for the rest of Dad's life. Dad inherited the Hondo Valley spread, but he felt that his elder brother, who'd taken the herd to Texas, had cheated him out of his share, and he was constantly filing lawsuits and appeals. He continued the campaign even after moving to West Texas, and he was also battling away with the other ranchers in the Hondo Valley, traveling back to New Mexico to lodge an endless stream of claims and counterclaims. One thing about Dad was that he had a terrible temper, and he usually returned from these trips trembling with rage. Part of it was his Irish blood, and part of it was his impatience with folks who had trouble understanding what he said. He felt those people thought he was a lame brain and were always trying to cheat him, whether it was his brothers and their lawyers, traveling merchants, or half-breed horse traders. He'd start sputtering and cursing, and from time to time, he'd become so incensed that he'd pull out his pistol and plug away at things, aiming to miss people, most of the time. Once he got into an argument with a tinker who overcharged to repair the kettle. When the tinker started to mock the way he talked, Dad ran inside to get his guns, but Loopy had seen what was coming and hidden them in her Navajo blanket. Dad worked himself into a lather, hollering about his missing guns, but I was convinced that Loopy saved that tinker's life. And probably Dad's as well, since if he'd killed the tinker, he might have ended up swinging, hanged like the man who'd shot his paw. Life would be easier, Dad kept saying, once we got our due. But we were only going to get it by fighting for it. Dad was all caught up in his lawsuits, but for the rest of us, the constant fight on Salt Draw was the one against the elements. The flash flood that sent Buster, Hell, and me up the Cottonwood wasn't the only one that almost did us in. Floods were pretty common in that part of Texas. You could count on one every couple of years. And when I was 8, we were hit by another big one. Dad was away in Austin filing another claim about his inheritance, when one night, Salt Draw overflowed and poured into our dugout. The sound of thunder awoke me, and when I got up, my feet sank into muddy water up to my ankles. Mom took Helen and Buster to high ground to pray, but I stayed behind with Apache and Lupe. We barricaded the door with a rug and started bailing the water out the window. Mom came back and begged us to go pray with her on the hilltop. "To heck with praying," I shouted. "Bail, damn it, bail." Mom looked mortified. I could tell she thought I'd probably doomed us all with my blasphemy, and I was a little shocked at it myself. But with the water rising so fast, the situation was dire. We had lit the kerosene lamp, and we could see that the walls of the dugout were beginning to sag inward. If Mom had pitched in and helped, there was a chance we might have been able to save the dugout. Not a good chance, but a fighting chance. Apache and Lupe and I couldn't do it on our own, though, and when the ceiling started to cave, we grabbed Mom's walnut headboard and pulled it through the door just as the dugout collapsed in on itself, burying everything. Afterwards, I was pretty aggravated with Mom. She kept saying that the flood was God's will and that we had to submit to it. But I didn't see things that way. Submitting seemed to me a lot like giving up. If God gave us the strength to bail, the gumption to try to save ourselves, isn't that what he wanted us to do? But the flood turned out to be a blessing in disguise. It was all too much for that tenderfoot, Mr. McClurg, who lived up in the draw in a two-room wooden house that he'd built with timber he carted in from New Mexico. The flood washed away Mr. McClurg's foundation, and the walls fell apart. He said he'd had it with this godforsaken part of the world and decided to return to Cleveland. As soon as Dad got home from Austin, he had us all jump in the wagon and, quickly, before anyone else in High Lonesome got the same idea, we drove over to scavenge Mr. McClurg's lumber. We took everything. Siding, rafters, beams, door frames, floorboards. By the end of the summer, we had built ourselves a brand new wooden house. And after we whitewashed it, you almost couldn't tell that it had been patched together with someone else's old wood. As we all stood there admiring our house the day we finished it, Mom turned to me and said, "Now, wasn't that flood God's will?" I didn't have an answer. Mom could say that in hindsight, but it seemed to me that when you were in the middle of something, it was awful hard to figure out what part of it was God's will and what wasn't. I asked Dad if he believed that everything that happened was God's will. "Is and isn't," he said. "God deals us all different hands. How we play them is up to us." I wondered if Dad thought that God had dealt him a bad hand, but I didn't feel it was my place to ask. From time to time, Dad had mentioned the horse kicking him in the head, but none of us ever talked about his gimp leg or his trouble speaking. Dad's speech impediment didn't make it sound a little like he was talking underwater. If he said, "Hitch up the carriage," it sounded to most people like, "Itch of her urge." And if he said, "Mama needs to rest," it sounded like, "Mama needs rest." Toya, the nearest little town, was 4 miles away, and sometimes when we went there, the kids followed Dad around imitating him, which made me want to thrash them something fierce. A lot of times, particularly when Mom was there too, Buster, Helen, and I could do little more than glare at them. Dad usually acted like those kids didn't exist. After all, he could hardly run for his gun to shoot them, like he had done with that tinker. But once, at the Toya stable, when a couple of them were especially loud, I saw him glance down with a wounded look. While he and Buster were loading the wagon, I went back to the stable and tried to explain to those kids that they were hurting people's feelings, but all they did was snicker. So I shoved them into the manure pile and ran. I'd never done a bad thing that gave me so much satisfaction. My only regret was that I couldn't tell Dad about it. What those kids didn't understand about Dad was that, although his speech did sound sort of marbly, he was smart. He'd been taught by a governess, and he was all the time reading books on philosophy and writing long letters to politicians like William Taft, William Jennings Bryan, and Frederick William Seward, who had been Abraham Lincoln's Assistant Secretary of State. Seward even wrote back letters Dad treasured and kept in a locked tin box. When it came to the written word, no one could string together sentences like Dad. His handwriting was elegant, if a little spidery, and his sentences were long and extravagant, filled with words like mendacious and abscond that most of the folks in Toya would need a dictionary to understand. Two of Dad's biggest concerns in his letters were industrialization and mechanization, which he felt were destroying the human soul. He was also obsessed with prohibition and phonetic spelling, both of which he saw as cures for mankind's tendency toward irrational behavior. Dad had come of age seeing too many liquored-up people blazing away at one another. His pa had sold liquor from the store he ran on the Rio Hondo Ranch. But his pa also once had to shoot a drunk who tried to shoot him. Alcohol, Dad said, made Indians and Irishmen crazy. After his pa was killed, Dad axed the store's liquor barrels. And, to Apache's deep regret, he didn't allow anything stronger than tea on the ranch. The inconsistent spelling of words in the English language also vexed Dad to no end. Digraphs such as SH and PH infuriated him, and silent letters made him grieve. If words were simply spelled the way they were pronounced, he argued, pretty much anyone who learned the alphabet could read, and that would virtually wipe out illiteracy. Toya had a one-room schoolhouse, but Dad thought that the teaching there was second rate, and he could do better tutoring me. Every day after lunch, when the sun was too hot to work outside, we did lessons, grammar, history, arithmetic, science, and the civics. And when we were done, I tutored Buster and Helen. Dad's favorite subject was history, but he taught it with a decidedly west of the Pecos point of view. As the proud son of an Irishman, he hated the English pilgrims, whom he called Poms, as well as most of the founding fathers. They're a bunch of pious hypocrites, he thought, who declared all men equal, but kept slaves and massacred peaceful Indians. He sided with the Mexicans in the Mexican-American War and thought the United States had stolen all of the land north of the Rio Grande. But he also thought the southern states should have had as much right to leave the Union as the colonies had to leave the British Empire. Only difference between a traitor and a patriot is your perspective, he said. I loved my lessons, particularly science and geometry, loved learning that there were these invisible rules that explained the mysteries of the world we lived in. Smart as that made me feel, Mom and Dad kept saying that even though I was getting a better education at home than any of the kids in Toya, I'd need to go to finishing school when I was 13, both to acquire social graces and to earn a diploma. Because in this world, Dad said, it's not enough to have a fine education. You need a piece of paper to prove you got it. Mom did her best to keep us kids genteel. While I was teaching Buster and Helen, she brushed my hair 100 strokes, careful to pull backward away from my scalp, putting marrow and lanolin into it to increase its luster. At night, she curled it into ringlets with little pieces of paper that she called papelitos. A lady's hair is her crowning glory, she said, and she was always going on about how my widow's peak was my best feature. But when I looked in the mirror, that little V of hair at the top of my forehead didn't seem like much to bank on. Even though we lived 4 miles from Toya, and days would go by without seeing anyone outside of the family, Mom worked very hard at being a lady. She was dainty, only 4.5 feet tall, and her feet were so small that she had to wear button-up boots made for girls. To keep her hands elegantly white, she rubbed them with pastes made from honey, lemon juice, and borax. She wore tight corsets to give her a teeny waist. I helped her lace them up, but they had the effect of causing her to faint. Mom called it the vapors and said it was a sign of her high breeding and delicate nature. I thought it was a sign that the corset made it hard to breathe. Whenever she'd keel over, I'd have to revive her with smelling salts, which she kept in a crystal bottle tied around her neck with a pink ribbon. Mom was closest to Helen, who had inherited her tiny hands and feet and her frail constitution. Sometimes they read poetry to each other, and in the stifling mid-afternoon heat, they'd simply lie together on Mom's chaise lounge. But while she was close to Helen, she completely doted on Buster, the only son, whom she considered the future of the family. Buster was a rabbity little kid, but he had an irresistible smile. And maybe to compensate for Dad's speech impediment, he was one of the fastest and smoothest talkers in the county. Mom liked to say Buster could charm the sage off the brush. She was always telling Buster there were no limits on what he could become, a railroad magnate, a cattle baron, a general, or even the governor of Texas. Mom didn't quite know what to make of me. She feared she might have trouble marrying me off because I didn't have the makings of a lady. I was a little bow-legged for one thing. Mom said it was because I rode horses too much. Also, my front teeth jutted out, so she bought me a red silk fan to cover my mouth. Whenever I laughed or smiled too big, Mom would say, "Lily dear, the fan." Since Mom wasn't exactly the most useful person in the world, One lesson I learned at an early age was how to get things done. And this was a source of both amazement and concern for Mom, who considered my behavior unladylike, but also counted on me. I never knew a girl to have such gumption, she'd say, but I'm not too sure that's a good thing. The way Mom saw it, women should let menfolk do the work because it made them feel more manly. That notion made sense only if you had a strong man willing to step up and get things done. And between Dad's gimp, Buster's elaborate excuses, and Apache's tendency to disappear, it was often up to me to keep the place from falling apart. But even when everyone was pitching in, we never got out from under all the work. I love that ranch, though sometimes it did seem that instead of us owning the place owned us. We'd heard about electricity and how some big cities back east were wired with so many glowing light bulbs that it looked like daytime even after the sun had set. But those wires had yet to reach West Texas, so you had to do everything by hand. Heating irons on the stove to press Mom's blouses, cooking cauldrons of lye and potash over the fire to make soap, working the pump, then toting clean water in to wash the dishes and dirty water out to pour on the vegetable garden. We'd also heard about the indoor plumbing that they were installing in fancy houses back east, but no one in West Texas had it. And most people, including Mom and Dad, thought the idea of an indoor bathroom was vile and disgusting. "Who in the Lord's name would want a crapper in the house?" Dad asked. Since I grew up listening to Dad, I always understood him completely. And when I turned 5, he had me start helping him train the horses. It took Dad 6 years to train a pair of carriage horses properly, and he had 6 teams going at all times, selling off 1 team a year, which was enough to make ends meet. A team had to be perfectly matched in size and color, with no irregularities, and if one horse had white socks, the other needed them as well. Of the 6 pairs of horses we'd have, Dad let the yearlings and 2-year-olds simply run free in the pasture. "First thing a horse needs to learn is to be a horse," he liked to say. I worked with the 3-year-olds, teaching them ground manners and getting them to accept the bit, then helped Dad harness and unharness 3 pairs of older horses. I'd drive each pair in a circle while Dad stood in the middle, using a whip to drill them, making sure they lifted their feet high, changed gaits in unison, and flexed their necks smartly. Everyone who spent time around horses, Dad liked to say, needed to learn to think like a horse. He was always repeating that phrase, "Think like a horse." The key to that, he said, was understanding that horses were always afraid. The only way they could save themselves from mountain lions and wolves was to kick out and run. And they ran like the wind, racing one another, because it was the slowest horse in the herd that got taken down by the predator. They were all the time looking for a protector, and if you could convince a horse that you'd protect him, he would do anything for you. Dad had a whole vocabulary of grunts, murmurs, clicks, talks, and whistles that he used to speak with the horses. It was like their own private language. He never flogged their backs, instead using the whip to make a small popping sound on either side of their ears, signaling them without ever hurting or frightening them. Dad also made tack for the horses, and he seemed happiest sitting by himself humming at his sewing machine, working the foot pedal, surrounded by hides, shears, cans of Neat's foot oil, spools of stitching thread, and his big saddler's needles. No one bothering him, no one feeling sorry for him, no one scratching their heads trying to figure out what it was he wanted to say. I was in charge of breaking the horses. It wasn't like breaking wild Mustangs, because our horses had been around us since they were foals. Most of the times, I simply climbed on bareback. If a horse was too skinny, its spine sometimes rubbed a raw spot on my behind, grabbed a handful of mane, gave them a nudge with my heels, and off we went. At first in awkward fits and starts, with a little crow hopping and swerving while the horse wondered what in tarnation a girl was doing on its back. But pretty soon, the horse usually accepted his fate, and we'd move along right nicely. After that, it was a matter of saddling him up and finding the best bit. Then you could set about training him. Still, particularly with a green horse, you never knew what to expect. And I got thrown plenty, which terrified Mom. But Dad just waved her off and helped me up. Most important thing in life, he would always say, is learning how to fall. Sometimes you fell in slow motion. The horse stumbled or shied. Your weight got thrown forward, and you ended up hugging the horse's neck, your feet losing their lock in the stirrups. If you couldn't right yourself, your best bet was to let go and roll off to the side, then keep rolling once you hit the ground. The dangerous falls were the ones that happened so fast you didn't have time to react. Dad once bought this big gray gelding for a song. The horse had been in the U.S. Cavalry, and since he was government issue, Dad named him Roosevelt. Maybe it was because Roosevelt had been fed too much grain. Maybe he'd heard too many bugle calls and too many cannons fired, or maybe he was just a born worrier. But for whatever reason, he was one spooky horse. Roosevelt was beautiful to look at, with dappled hindquarters and dark legs, but sudden noises or movement made him jump up like a jackrabbit. Shortly after we got Roosevelt, I was riding him back to the barn when a hawk swooped down in front of us. Roosevelt spun around, and I was flung off him like a rock out of a slingshot. I tried to break the fall with my arm, and it ended up snapping my forearm clean in two. The jagged ends of the bones were poking up, making a bulge under my skin. Dad was always telling me I was one tough nut, but with my arm bent and dangling like that, danged if I didn't start bawling like a little girl. Dad carried me into the kitchen, and when Mom saw me, she got so upset she started gasping for breath, telling Dad when she could get the words out that a little girl like me had no business breaking horses. Dad told Mom that she best leave until she could get control of herself, and she went into the bedroom, closing the door behind her. Dad set the bone and had Lupe cut strips of linen while he made up a paste of chalk, gum, eggs, and flour. Then he wrapped the linen strips around my arm and smeared them all over with a paste. Dad took me into his arms, and we sat on the porch looking at the distant mountains. After a while, I stopped crying because there just wasn't any cry left in me by then. I sat there with my head on my shoulder like a little bird with a broken wing. "Dumb horse," I finally said. "Never blame the horse," Dad said. "It's just something he learned along the way. And horses aren't dumb. They know what they need to know. Matter of fact, I always figured horses are smarter than they let on. Kind of like the Indians, who pretend they can't speak English because no good ever came from talking with the Anglos." Dad told me I'd be back in the saddle in 4 weeks, and I was. "Next time," Dad said, "don't try to break a fall." "Next time?" Mom asked. "I trust there won't be a next time." "Hope for the best and plan for the worst," Dad said. "Anyway," he told me, "once you're going down, accept it and let your rump take the punishment. Your body knows how to fall." Meanwhile, Dad enrolled Roosevelt in what he called Adam Casey's School for Wayward Horses. He tied Roosevelt's head to his tail and left him to stand in a stall until he learned patience. He filled empty tin cans with pebbles and tied those to his mane and tail until Roosevelt got used to the commotion. Once Roosevelt was reformed, more or less, Dad sold him at a nice profit to some Easterners bound for California. While Dad didn't blame horses for anything, he wasn't sentimental about them either. "If you can't stop a horse, sell him," Dad liked to say. "And if you can't sell him, shoot him." Another one of my jobs was feeding the chickens and collecting the eggs. We had about 2 dozen chickens and a few roosters. First thing every morning, I'd toss them a handful of corn and some table scraps and add lime to their water to make the eggshells strong. In the spring, when the hens were really fertile, I could collect 100 eggs a week. We'd set aside 25 or 30 for eating, and once a week, I drove the buckboard into Toya to sell the rest to the grocer, Mr. Clutterbuck, a pinched man who wore garters on his sleeves and toted up sales figures on the brown paper he wrapped your goods in. He paid a penny per egg, then sold them for 2 cents each, which seemed unfair to me since I'd done all the work, raising the chickens, collecting the eggs, and bringing them into town. But Mr. Clutterbuck just said, "Sorry, kid, that's the way the world works." I also brought in peacock eggs, finally giving those showy old birds a way to earn their keep. At first, I thought they'd fetch twice as much as chicken eggs, seeing as how they were twice as big. But Mr. Clutterbuck would give me only a penny each for them. "Eggs an egg," he said. I thought that danged grocer was cheating me because I was a girl, but there wasn't a whole lot I could do about it. That was the way the world worked. Dad said it was good for me to go into town and bargain with Mr. Clutterbuck over egg prices. It honed my math and taught me the art of negotiation, all of which was going to help me achieve my purpose in life. Dad was a philosopher and had what he called his theory of purpose, which held that everything in life had a purpose, and unless it achieved that purpose, it was just taking up space on the planet and wasting everybody's time. That was why Dad never bought any of us kids toys. Play was a waste of time, he said. Instead of playing house or playing with dolls, girls were better off cleaning a real house or looking after a real baby if their purpose in life was to become a mother. Dad didn't actually forbid us from ever playing, and sometimes Buster, Helen, and I rode over the Dingler Ranch for a game of baseball with the Dingler kids. Because we didn't have enough players for two full teams, we made up a lot of our own rules, one being that you could get a runner out by throwing the ball at him. Once when I was 10 and trying to steal a base, one of the Dingler boys threw a ball at me hard, and it hit me in the stomach. I doubled over, and when the pain wouldn't go away, Dad took me into Toya, where the barber who sometimes sewed up people said my appendix had been ruptured, and I needed to get up to the hospital in Santa Fe. We caught the next stagecoach, and by the time we got to Santa Fe, I was delirious. And what I remember next was waking up in the hospital with stitches on my stomach, Dad sitting next to me. "Don't worry, Angel," he said. The appendix, he explained, was a vestigial organ, which meant it had no purpose. If I had to lose an organ, I'd chosen the right one. But, he went on, I'd almost lost my life. And to what end? I'd only been playing a game of baseball. If I wanted to risk my life, I should do it for a purpose. I decided Dad was right. All I had to do was figure out what my purpose was. If you want to be reminded of the love of the Lord, Mom always said, just watch the sun rise. And if you want to be reminded of the wrath of the Lord, Dad said, watch a tornado. Living on Salt Draw, we saw our share of tornadoes, which we feared even more than those flash floods. On most occasions, they looked like narrow cones of gray smoke, but sometimes when it had been especially dry, they were almost clear, and you could see tree limbs and brush and rocks swirling at the bottom. From a distance, they seemed to be moving slowly, as if underwater, spinning and swaying almost elegantly. Most weren't more than a dust devil gone a little wild, ripping at the laundry on the clothesline and sending the chickens squawking. But once when I was 11 years old, a monster came roaring across the range. Dad and I were working with the horses when the sky turned dark real quickly and the air got heavy. You could smell and taste what was heading our way. Dad saw the tornado first, coming in from the east, a wide funnel reaching from the clouds to the earth. I set about unharnessing the horses while Dad ran in to warn Mom, who started opening all the windows in the house because she'd been told that would equalize the air pressure and make it less likely that the house would explode. The horses were stampeding like crazy around the corral. Dad didn't want them trapped, so we opened the gate and they galloped through it, heading across the range away from the tornado. Dad said if we got through this, we could worry about the horses later. By then, the sky overhead was black and streaked with rain, but off in the distance you could see sunlight slanting through the golden clouds, and I took that as a sign. Dad had us all, including Apache and Lupe, scramble into the crawl space under the house. As the tornado came closer, it whipped up sand and branches and broken bits of wood in one big swirl around the house, roaring so loud it sounded like we were right under a freight train. Mom grabbed our hands to pray, and while I didn't usually feel the call, I was scared, scarier than I'd ever been. And I started praying harder than I'd ever prayed, asking God to please forgive my earlier lack of sincere faith and promising that if He spared us, I'd pray to Him and worship Him every day for the rest of my life. Right then, we heard a crash and the sound of splintering wood. The house seemed to groan and shudder, but the floor above our heads held fast, and very quickly the tornado moved on. Everything grew quiet. We were alive. The tornado had missed the house, but it had plucked up the windmill and smashed it down on the roof. The house, made from wood that had already been busted apart once in that flood, was a total wreck. Dad started cussing up a blues streak. Life, he declared, had cheated him once again. "If I owned hell and West Texas," he said, "I do believe I'd sell West Texas and live in hell." Dad predicted that the horses would come back at feeding time. And when they did, he hitched the 6-year-olds to the carriage and drove into town to use the telegraph. After some backing and forthing with folks in the Hondo Valley, Dad reckoned he was not going to be tried again on that phony old murder charge, and it was safe to return to New Mexico and take up life on the Casey Ranch, which he'd been renting out to tenant farmers all these years. The chickens had disappeared in the tornado, but we had most of the peacocks, the 6 pairs of horses, the brood mares and cows, and a number of Mom's choice heirlooms, such as the walnut headboard that we'd rescued from the dugout. We packed it all into 2 wagons. Dad took the reins of one with Mom and Helen next to him. Apache and Lupe were in the second. Buster and I followed on horseback with the rest of the herd on a string. At the gate, I stopped and looked back at the ranch. The windmill still lay toppled over the caved-in house, and the yard was strewn with branches. Dad was always going on about Easterners who came out to West Texas but weren't tough enough to cut it. And now we were folding our hand as well. Sometimes it didn't matter how much gumption you had. What mattered were the cards you'd been dealt. Life had been hard in West Texas, but that low, yellow land was all I knew, and I loved it. Mom was saying, as she always did, that it was God's will, and this time I accepted it. God had saved us, but He had also taken our house from us. Whether as payment for saving us or as punishment because we didn't deserve it, I couldn't say. Maybe He was just giving us a kick in the behind to say, time to move on. Chapter 2. The Miraculous Staircase. We traveled 3 days to reach the Casey Ranch, which Dad, with his love of phonetic spelling, insisted should officially be renamed the KC Ranch. It was in the middle of the Hondo Valley, south of the Capitan Mountains, and the countryside was so green that when I first laid eyes on it, I could hardly believe what I was seeing. The ranch was really more of a farm, with fields of alfalfa, rows of tomato vines, and orchards of peach trees and pecan trees planted 100 years ago by the Spanish. The pecan trees were so big that when Helen and Buster and I joined hands, we couldn't reach all the way around. The house, which Dad's pa had bought from a Frenchman when he first moved to the area, was made of adobe and stone. There were 2 bedrooms inside, so the grown-ups and kids didn't have to sleep in the same room, and a woodshed outside for Lupe, while Apache took over one of the barn stalls. I couldn't believe we would live in such grandeur. The walls were as thick as Dad's forearm was long. "No tornado's ever gonna knock this feller down," he said. The next day, while we were unpacking, Dad hollered for us to come outside. I had never seen him so excited. We ran out the door, and Dad was standing in the yard, pointing up at the sky. There, floating in the air above the horizon, was an upside-down town. You could see the low, flat stores, the adobe church, the horses tied to the hitching posts, and the people walking in the streets. We all stared slack-jawed, and Lupe made a sign of the cross. It wasn't a miracle, Dad said. It was a mirage of Tinney, the town about 6 miles away. To me, the mirage seemed nothing short of a miracle. It was huge, taking up a big hunk of the sky, and I was mesmerized watching those upside-down people silently walking along those upside-down streets. We all stood staring at the mirage for the longest time. Then it got all fuzzy and faded, until it finally disappeared. We'd seen mirages before, patches of blue on the ground that looked for all the world like puddles on the driest days. Dad said that those were ground mirages, and what looked like water on the ground was really the sky. This was a heavenly mirage, he said, which was created when the air closer to the ground was cooler than the air above it. Even though I was usually good at science, I couldn't grasp what Dad was saying. He drew a diagram in the dirt, showing me how the light was refracted by the cool air, which bent it along the curve of the Earth's surface. The idea of light somehow bending didn't make any sense until Dad reminded me that when you held up a glass of water, your fingers on the far side of the glass looked like they'd been chopped off and moved. That was because the water was bending the light, and the cold air did the same. All of a sudden, what Dad was saying did make sense, and the knowledge of it truly lit me up. Dad, who was watching me, said, "Eureka!" He started telling me about this ancient Greek fellow named Archimedes, who ran naked through the street shouting, "Eureka!" after he figured out a way to calculate volume while sitting in his bathtub. I could see why Archimedes got all excited. There was nothing finer than that feeling that came rushing through you when it clicked and you suddenly understood something that had puzzled you. It made you think, it just might be possible to get a handle on this old world after all. Dad relished the notion of being a big landowner, but not the headaches that came with it. Instead of the fenced-in rangeland we had in West Texas, there were now fields to be tilled, planted, and weeded, peaches picked, pecans collected, manure spread, watermelons hauled to market, migrants hired and fed. Because of his gimp leg, some of the work, like pruning peach trees from a ladder, was beyond Dad, and his speech impediment made it hard for the help to understand him. So even though I was still only 11, I took on the hiring and overseeing. Also, Dad was never the most practical man in the world. And in New Mexico, he started getting caught up in all sorts of projects that had nothing to do with running the farm. We were still training horses, and Dad was still writing politicians and newspapers, railing against modernization. But now he spent hours making two copies of every letter he wrote, filing one in his desk and keeping the other in the barn in case the house burned down. At the same time, Dad was working on a book, arguing the case for phonetic spelling. He called it a goatee out of water. Goatee, he liked to point out, could be pronounced like fish. The GH had the F sound in enough, the O had the short I sound in women, and the TI had the sh sound in nation. Dad also started a biography of Billy the Kid, who had stopped at the Casey Ranch when Dad was a teenager and asked to swap his spent horse for a fresh mount. Right polite feller, Dad always said, and sat a horse well. It turned out the kid had been on the run, as Dad found out an hour later when a posse stopped and also asked to swap horses. Dad, secretly rooting for the kid, passed off some old nags on them. Now in New Mexico, he became so obsessed with the kid that he put a tintype of him on the wall. Mom hated the kid, whom she called two-bit trash, because he'd killed a man who was engaged to her cousin, and she hung that fellow's picture next to the kid's. Dad felt the cousin must have deserved to die.